Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this week's show. Tonight we're going to be talking with Gordon White, and this is one of two parts. If you're a Patreon, you're going to get the second part right away. Michael Hughes helps me with this interview, and I always love talking to Gordon. He's so well-versed in such a variety of topics. He's the host of a podcast called Rune Soup that deals with magic and culture. So check that out. And I also just posted a rare Patreon-only show, like a full show. And the only reason, we really can't air it as a public show. So if you're a Patreon, you got our show on Altered States. That was done the same night we did the Christianity and the Occult show. And Rojan kind of ran that one a little bit too, and it was a very interesting discussion. If you want to become a patron, go to whereattheroadgo.com. In the corner, you can see a link for Patreon. It's $3 a month, so it helps us out greatly. If you want to support the show, if you like the show, of course, if you don't want to become a patron and you want to help us out, just spread the word. It's always appreciated. Thank you for everyone who listens. And here's part one of the conversation with Gordon. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? And I am joined today by Michael Hughes.
And hey there.
We are talking tonight with Gordon White of the Rune Soup podcast.
And
thank you. Hello.
This is two of my favorite podcasts rolled into one. So I'm very excited. It's like my chocolate meeting peanut butter.
Well, that's very efficient.
Now, Gordon, you have a book out, your most recent book. I don't want to say it's new, because it came out end of last July, right?
Yep.
And this is called Pieces of Eight, and it's basically a collection of essays, right?
It is. It's a look at the a few dozen areas in contemporary magic, and in particular, contemporary chaos magic, and deciding whether they need to be viewed again or updated from a position perspective in some way, given that chaos magic has grown in popularity, but potentially not grown in understanding as it's grown in popularity.
Okay. For people who are not familiar, can you kind of define what chaos magic is and what it's not?
Yeah, absolutely. So chaos magic emerged out of some iconoclastic magical experimentation in Britain in the mid-80s, principally the work of Ray Schoen and Pete Carroll. And they were looking at what was going on in a fairly moribund British magical scene, kind of struggling out of the 70s. And in some of the other orders, and it's not my place to talk about it, but in some of the other orders, they'd essentially collapsed and had to have lineages recharged from overseas, and it was a kind of mess of arguments and things that really hadn't been examined for about 70 years, pretty much since the heyday of the Victorian / Edwardian magicians. So they started experimenting with different methods and ways of breaking and jailbreaking Western magic, and principally that had to do with working out practice. Finding the edges of practice. So working out what you could do if it was an Apollonian rite. Can you use Superman? Can you? And the famous one in Pete's book is mapping the cast of Rocky Horror onto the sort of Christian appropriated Kabbalistic tree of life, and all this kind of stuff to just kind of mess with it and see where the edges of it are. And its name emerged because the other thing that was happening conceptually in the 80s was the rise of complexity theory and specifically chaos mathematics. So Pete said that he basically had read James Gleick's book Chaos, and that's where the name of it came from. Now this was this proved to be quite popular. So his original books were self-published in the UK, and then they were picked up by a US publisher, and it started to kind of grow, and it grew just at the time that desktop publishing and sort of BBS systems were turning into the early days of the internet. And so it got very caught up in the in that digital utopianism of identity expression and information wanting to be free and all the kind of fun stuff that we remember. And I certainly got caught up in it. And that was quite a good decade for it to happen culturally, because you had comics like The Invisibles, and you had The Fifth Element and The Matrix, and you had The X-Files, and even at the beginning of it, you even had Twin Peaks. And so the newsphere was very amenable to this amorphous, barely digital experimentation and communication. Now, that had been retained, I guess, as people's conception of chaos magic, even though it's not where it was formed, it's just where it grew in popularity. And its position, and there's a failing on both sides here. There's a failing on people who aren't involved in chaos magic to view it that way, but there's a failing from within chaos magic to kind of look at it and realize, well, this is no longer reflective of the core principles of chaos magic. And the main one, and it's its blessing and its curse, is an emphasis on getting results. So you can't, and more particularly, you cannot justify your failures. And that's quite harsh. It's good, but it's harsh. And it's also necessarily limiting. It kind of hives off the mysticism that magic, and particularly failures in magic, will coat themselves in. But, you know, some of that has some benefit. And so it's its blessing and its curse. And the kind of point of Pieces of Eight was to look back at the story of chaos magic and the areas of wider magic in which it has an opinion, and see which positions still hold.
Okay.
Which positions still do hold? That's a good question, I think.
I think the emphasis on results remains, and I think the interest in... And this is the big change. So if you look at it, but it's an evolution rather than, so it's a qualitative rather than quantitative change. If you look underneath the interest in, say, complexity theory and chaos mathematics in the 80s, what you're essentially looking at, and it's the same thing as results, you're essentially looking at a data-led worldview. And bearing in mind, and that I think still holds today, and one of the biggest sort of changes is the data sets. I mean, you know what the show's about. The data sets in 2017 are very different, particularly when it comes to psi phenomena and so on, to the data sets in the 80s. But the underlying idea, which is if you have data, build on it, but also know the limitations of data. So, and that's a big one. And one of the necessary implications of that, and that sort of analysis of new data sets, is a look back on some of the experimentations that happened in the 90s, like, you know, can you use Superman in place of Apollo? Looking back on it and saying, well, can you, or does it work better as from a results perspective if you stick with an Apollonian approach instead? And it would appear that that is indeed the case.
Now, why is that the case? You've said that, you know, if you replace Apollo with Superman, you still get some results, but not anywhere near as good. Could that be because in the deeper part of our mind, we realize that Superman is fictional, whereas Apollo might resonate with a deeper, more mythological sort of thing with us being older?
Well, it could, but then the words that require further definition there that you've just said are mind and fiction and mythology. So, and actually this is one of the sort of shortcomings, I would say, of the kind of Pete Carroll approach, and he acknowledges this. Is it necessarily, chaos magic necessarily hasn't been particularly good at looking at those kind of pieces. It's essentially it's almost too materialist for its own good, and that is a side effect of the focus on results. But if you look at those three terms and give them further definition, then you're in a really interesting area, because again, returning to one of the core differences between today and say the 80s is the data we have around the impact of psychology and mythology and fiction. So it's not necessarily clean cut, and this is why I think chaos magic retains its widespread unpopularity in the wider magical world. Is you can't just jump along with the more fundamentalist grimoire magicians and say, oh, well, then we'll just do it this way. You go, well, you can, but there is potentially more going on.
That brings up a question I've always found interesting, and that is, what does chaos magic with its, you know, its sense of relativism as far as the reality of spirits as compared to thought forms or you know, again, the Superman Apollo sort of thing versus some of the older traditions or traditions that, you know, have a more, you know, quote unquote reality, stress the reality of spirits as individual entities?
Well, that is one of the pieces that I think requires, and it's covered in pieces of eight, requires urgent updating. If you look at how spirits were conceptualized, not just in chaos magic, but in the 80s and 90s, it's based on some very poor models in sort of wider psychology, but also magic specifically. So the psychology one happened with essentially the mid-20th century materialist turn. Psychologists pretend what they're doing isn't magic, and as a result, it's a mess. And it's only now kind of crawling out of that mess. I think in 100 years' time, we'll be able to sort of date psychology in eras. So you have a Jungian era, then you have Lost in the Wasteland, then you have what psychology does since the publication of the Red Book in 2005. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the big changes. But when it comes to the conceptions of the grimoires, even up until the 90s, it was a very, very poor, poorly conceptualized world. And that's historical. So, and it's essentially Crowley's fault. Crowley stole and republished. Go on.
No, go ahead.
All right. Yeah. So Crowley stole and republished Mather's translation of The Lesser Key of Solomon. And he must have been, you know, Crowley being Crowley, he must have been off his face for the entire time he did this, because it's a mess. He actually just gets it wrong. His pictures are terrible. He declares himself a dead Rosicrucian at one point in the book. And one of the things he does is he says the spirits of the Goetia are aspects of the human brain. Now, Crowley knows the difference between mind and brain. So the whole thing could have been a Mather's troll, for all we know. Unfortunately, because of this sort of epistemological timidity of Western magic in the 20th century up until chaos magic, people just sort of trundled along. And you can read books from all the way up to the 90s where people say the same thing, that, oh, well, just think of the grimoire spirit, well, the Goetia, as aspects of the human brain. And that's not correct. It's also, it's not correct in the understanding of psi data and all the rest of it that we have today. Mm-hmm. But it was also never there. And it was never there where Mathers said it. And kind of compounding it, and this is somewhat inside baseball, the Lesser Key itself, Mathers kind of almost begrudgingly translated because he didn't necessarily like it. And it is a messed up version of a more coherent spirit list. So we're kind of mistranslated a broken spirit list and called the broken things part of the human brain. By the end of the 20th century, you couldn't be in a worse state from a grimoire perspective. And that's been, I guess, the big major change in magic in general, not just chaos magic in the last 15 years, has been the growing awareness of the context and origins of grimoires, what they actually contain, and running alongside that has been a renewed academic interest in things like Western magic and the Greek magic papyri and so on.
Okay. I forgot the question I was going to ask you earlier. Okay. Let's go into the idea of folk magic. And one of the things you talk about is that there was some sort of a system of folk magic at one point.
Well, if you're referring to Europe, yes, without question. In fact, kind of referring back to what I was just saying, you can academically clump the history of Western magic into and it's an academic distinction, but it's actually an academic distinction that's been used from about the 13th century. So you have natural magic, which we might necessarily call folk magic, and that is the classical survivals of technical Hermetic herb lore, messed up astrology, and the incorporation of the sort of emerging saintly tradition and the use of relics and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's one, and that is what we would. It's a problematic term which we'll come around to. That is folk magic. The other two, then you have image magic. And this is the astrological practices that returned to Europe via Moorish Spain. And examples of that would be things like the Picatrix. But essentially, you make a thing at the right time, and it retains whatever the astrological energy is. So that's image magic. And then the third one, which we might as well call Solomonic or, you know, necromantic or so on, which deals specifically with a magical technical protocols for the evocation of spirits. And that's the kind of core part of, I guess, grimoires. That came over from the collapse of, you know, the Byzantine Empire in the 13th, 14th century, 14th, 15th. And folk magic then was the survival of the chaos of the classical world until about the 17th century. And then we started to get printing, and then you start to see things like Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft and almanacs and so on, sort of moving into the cunning traditions of Northwest Europe. And you get a, with the rise of literacy, you get a very haphazard adoption of some of these pieces. So folk magic is a survival at its very beginning of something that's probably gone on for 200,000 years. But the folk magic of, say, Britain that has subsequently informed most of the practice of Western magic in the Anglosphere is that plus the impact of these different books in about the 17th century. And in a sense, there's a funny map to chaos magic there, which is why I'm very interested in the idea of folk magic, because it's about finding and retaining the pieces that appear to work the best for you within your context.
Now, folk magic, as far as European folk magic, is there sort of a template among humans in general that exists in folk magic traditions outside of Europe as well, like the African traditions, Asian traditions? Do you see any do you see like sort of an practice of magic in just human consciousness in general?
Leaving aside the dangers of universalism, obviously, let's just, you know, that's typical. Yes, although I'm not sure if I would describe it as as much as there will be a shape, and there is a shape that the entire world has landed on by trial and error, assuming that the spirit world has some separate existence, which it appears to have, again, referring back to things like psi data and UFO phenomena and so on. Mm-hmm. So as a result, you do get, again, this is a dangerous term, you do get the kind of universal praxis motifs in spirit customs and folk magic generally around the world. And they principally are the notion that different ideas and forces are embodied in objects, stones, plants, and so on, and that there is some kind of extra-dimensional interaction required, so dealing, trading with the spirit world in some way to maintain a kind of optimal human life conditions. And that's pretty much it. The other component of it is timing. So something to do with the timing of things. And that doesn't, so that kind of describes something without really describing it. It's not necessarily detailed enough to do so. But you won't find anywhere on the planet where those aren't the sort of cornerstones of how we experience and interact with I guess, the wider universe.
Now, would that be in general sort of an animistic, something animistic ideas underlying most traditional folk magic practices? Do you think we could kind of, you know, isolate it to animism or no?
Yeah, I think we should, and I also think we should, because the term itself, there's a sort of sense of re-haunting the academy in doing it, because the term animism isn't actually applied to animistic cultures by themselves. It emerges from a high imperial materialist worldview, and it was essentially emerged as a way of kind of explaining why brown people are so dumb, basically, is where it came from. And so Taylor, who was a sort of early anthropologist who first coined the term, decided it was because they couldn't tell the difference between their dreams and reality. Mm-hmm. Now, there is something really delightful and almost empowering about re-haunting that word, because he was an unashamed imperialist and materialist and rationalist and all these things. And if you look at how the more competent parts of the academy are using animism as a term now, it's better described as the extension of personhood to non-humans. Now, that is a really profound way of thinking about it, because it doesn't necessarily make objective spirit truth claims about things. So a river or a mountain range or a tree or collection of trees is granted the status of personhood within these cultures. And that means you're dealing with a way of experiencing the world that is relational. And in that sense, in that definition of animism, it absolutely underpins, on a universal basis, it underpins this sort of practice of folk magic. Beyond that, you start to, wherever you are around the world, you start to get versions of almost like platonic splits. So is the tree a spirit, or does it have a spirit? Well, it depends where you are in the world to have that. But at that baseline, this extension of personhood is fundamentally a component of magic, because from that tumbles the idea of sacred objects and sacred stones and the use of plants, and crucially, how you relate to these objects rather than extract and use them.
Mm-hmm. How do we know that these things are actual other spirits or some kind of other to us and not some projection from us?
Well, we don't. Okay. Is a good way of thinking about it. There is the modern. So this idea of animism that I just described is half based on a kind of experiential formulation. So if you practice magic, you kind of end up there. But the other half of it is, this is a better way of living in the world than the kind of Cartesian split naturalism that we have today. And from that has fallen many, many sins. So there's a part of it that is deliberately, and this is kind of why I use the word haunting the academy, there's a part of it that's quite deliberate, which is we deliberately adopt a belief system that is a better match for not only the experience of magic, but it's probably a better way of living in the world. So that's the first bit. Mm-hmm. The other part is what I think is particularly, maybe the most interesting philosophical turn in the 20th century was around the existential turn, where people are looking at what impact human consciousness has on the formulation of reality and where meaning is located, if it's something that is kind of projected out of us or if it is inherent in the wider universe. And sitting in the middle there is this kind of exciting philosophical tension. Because I think in both cases, it's all internal is a lazy solve, and it's all external is a lazy solve. And there's something in the middle, which is there's something to do with our experience of reality reaches out and finds meaning, but that process is kind of, in some sense, crucial to the universe. And you see how it fits very nicely with the extension of personhood to non-humans. When you put those two things together, you're kind of halfway to a really nice conception of the universe as an evolving organism existing to experience itself. And that, I think, is a very pleasant universe to live in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, that's fair enough. How would you define magic in general?
Yeah, magic. And if we're talking about practical enchantment, magic is a culture-specific way of describing the various practices and culture effects that are implied by UFO data and psi phenomena and so on. So wherever you are around the world, you have different ways of describing essentially some highly conserved human relational capacities. And that seems to be, I think, the best way to look at how to work out what we do in a kind of decolonizing time. to work out how we have things in tension and comparison without making truth claims that we can't make. So essentially, magic is how we describe naturally occurring consciousness effects within ourselves and also pre-existing separate beings that aren't us out there in the world.
Okay. You talked, well, let's get into this. You talk a little bit about science research, and I think we're kind of on the same wavelength here, that science is important, but some of the stuff that's going on now is so stuck in materialism that it's actually holding everything back.
Yeah, well, it's holding public science back. I'm not sure if that's the case for behind the curtain science, but this premise, this sort of 19th century premise that the only things that exist are physical, has been sort of repeatedly falsified. So it was falsified with the early 20th century quantum theorists. It was falsified by postmodernism in the 70s, and it's sort of been falsified in the last 10 years with the emergence of, and the sort of public uptake of psi data. So it's had three fatal gunshot wounds, and nevertheless, and funnily enough, if you deal with quote-unquote proper scientists, they're not that interested in it. And it's not been philosophically interesting since the 70s either. But if you deal with science journalists or you read The Guardian, this idea that this premise matches reality is still there. And it absolutely holds, like a good example, it absolutely holds anything back. So you guys would have read Dr. Kreipl's The Supernatural.
Yes.
Towards the end, Whitley Strieber kind of says, whatever these visitors are, I have the sensation that they are at least some of them are a civilization that has learned how to communicate across the death barrier. Now that's quite interesting, because if you consider the rise of spiritualism in the late 19th century, we were, as we have all these kind of clunky devices, and as a result, some fairly idiotic views of how the spirit world might work. But if we'd carried on with working out how a telegraph and a phonograph and what have you might be used to talk to discarnate entities, can you imagine, as if you look at the technological turn that happened in the 20th century, we'd probably be there. We would probably have a way of cleanly communicating across the death barrier. Now, what might come from those conversations? You have a kind of runaway climate change effect of human civilization if we can talk to people, if we can run science experiments from both sides of the death divide simultaneously, how long before we all have flying saucers? And so these are the things, like that is a sort of fantastical example, but these are the kind of things that are utterly missed by a falsified premise that the only things that exist are physical. And it's kind of messed everything up. We're stuck with a model of public physics, although I suspect the deep state physics is very different, but we're stuck with a model of public physics that is utterly broken and has been for 30 years and no one's doing anything about it because they have literally looked under every cushion for a way to make materialism still work. And now we're here with the unfalsifiable string theory that they're just kind of pulling further and further away from evidential results because they can't, if it's wrong, the whole thing is wrong. And that apparently they can't stand.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of the issue with the Big Bang Theory as well.
Yeah, of course. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was invented by a Catholic priest based on Babylonian mythology as a kind of attempt to see if, and this is a very 19th century idea, and I'll come around to why I think that is in a sec, but to see if there is a way you can get a broad match between essentially creationism and the physical universe. And so we have this accepted model, which doesn't work from a redshift perspective, but also doesn't work intellectually or philosophically because as Dr. Sheldrake points out, it's essentially Neoplatonism because for it to happen, all the laws of the universe have to exist in some supernal non-physical realm prior to the Big Bang, mm-hmm. at which point all these forces start working on them. So what is this realm with the forces in it? Yeah. And it doesn't match. It doesn't match at all. But nevertheless, it's the least worst one they have because if you actually, and this is something I delight in doing in the 21st century, if you bundle pull up all the anomalies in physics and biology and psi research and so on, you're stuck with a really fun, haunted living universe. And that's probably a better description of what's going on. Now, the Big Bang is a sort of physics, but I just want to come back to this 19th century idea. The other one that I think is magic specific. It wasn't just the Big Bang. There was, in the 19th century, in a desperate attempt to kind of keep an idea of the afterlife, it was deemed to be more scientific to sort of say, once you die, your spirit or consciousness sort of just diffuses into this divine white light. And maybe that's what heaven, and maybe that's what God is. And it was, it's kind of dumb because, well, it's very dumb because no one else in the world has that idea or ever had it, and it was viewed as this kind of sciencey way of talking about the afterlife. Now, we're still kind of there. For the people who are quote-unquote believers, they'll end up with this kind of silly premise that was essentially just there to make sure people still go to church in Bedfordshire in the 1800s. Now, that isn't a very good model of the afterlife or a spirit world if you intend to interact with it. So that kind of 19th century materialist turn's impact on how the West views spirit worlds has held magic back. It hasn't done anything to science, but it's held us back. So we're still kind of living in the sort of shadows of imperial worldviews until we turn around and look at them. And that's the sort of decolonial turn that I think is particularly interesting now.
It also, you know, that idea of that sort of nebulous afterlife is contradicted by personal experience of so many people. So, you know, it's one of those things, you know, do you believe your own experiences, which, you know, so many people, when you get them talking, talk about, you know, apparitions, visitations from the dead, communications, messages, that sort of thing that implies, you know, very much a personal sort of afterlife rather than, you know, the amorphous return to the source kind of thing.
There isn't a single NDE that matches that. There isn't a single one. The afterlife as experienced in after-death research is never that. Not once has it been that. It has been somewhere that actually has landscape and separate beings and so on. And there isn't a single example of it. And I know people might want to jump up and say, oh, what about Buddhism? Funnily enough, if you think that about the Buddhist between realms, then you don't really understand Buddhism. You understand the 19th century understanding of Buddhism, because it's a very crowded place between those incarnations. So literally nowhere. Literally nowhere has this amorphous white light thing. So even for people who are prepared to explore magic as a way of understanding themselves and the world, if they don't look at where their ideas come from, and chaos magic is very good at this, if they don't look at where their ideas come from, they're going to struggle with it.
And then there's the, you know, the reincarnation aspects of Buddhism, you know, which sort of negates that whole whole idea too. And you know, I listened to your show with Leslie Kane, which was fantastic. And so it's even contradicted in Buddhism. So, like you said,
yeah. So last year I had Jack Hunter on, who's a UK academic, and he's very interested in Charles Fort, and Fort decided we were in the dominant of witchcraft. So instead of eons, he uses dominant. And he says, this is the kind of worldview that's emerging now. And obviously I adore that as an idea, but it's also probably quite prescient, because this bundling up that I know we'd like to do, and I absolutely delight in the bundling up of the anomalous, the world, the universe is crazy, like in a good sense. It is this sort of chaotic coming and going of different beings, human and otherwise, in with different capacities, relating and interrelating. And it just looks like the dominant of witchcraft. If you're trying to find a coherent model of how, and I mean that as a model, I don't mean like, haha, we found the answer. I mean, if you're looking for a coherent model, it has to look like that. It has to look like some kind of, I mean, I cheekily last year called it space shamanism, but it kind of has to look like that.
And we are talking with Gordon White, for anyone who is just tuning in. Your podcast is Rune Soup, and we're talking about your new book, pieces of eight. And I want to jump back to the Buddhism thing again, but despite all the reincarnation and stuff, isn't the ultimate goal in Buddhism to achieve sort of that nirvana, which is sort of an ultimate nothingness, uniting with the source?
Potentially. That does appear to be what... I've never found it, and speaking of Crowley, Crowley said, or wrote once, that the Buddha should have known better. And when you're dealing with Western understandings of sort of Eurasian worldviews, there's a kind of challenge of navigating the Orientalism of it. And one of the things that we miss as we Orientalize the East is the control system components of their religions, because we have them, we acknowledge them in the West.
Sure.
And very often that's one of the reasons why we go looking East for our tradition. But they're found there as well. And you kind of have implied in the, I think, very unsatisfying fundamental or eventual promise of Buddhism, you get the sort of the shadow of a Hindu caste system and the rest of it, because you essentially have non-physical bloodlines running the politics of the place, because you go around and find children that are the same person as they were the last time. And in the reincarnational model and its promise, you find a control system, which is be good this year or be good this lifetime, and maybe next time you won't be a peasant.
Yeah.
Maybe the time after that you won't have to come back, because being a peasant isn't very good. And so there's a kind of, there's a political challenge. Well, there's a challenging political perspective on examining these things, because it's sort of a Eurasian version of something like original sin. So we kind of have to be careful about which parts of that we use and find enriching, and which parts of that we acknowledge as a control system, which of course they would have just as we did.
Okay, fair enough. Let's take a look. You've mentioned it a few times. Let's look at some of the Psi research that impresses you.
Oh, where to begin? I think the parts that impress, well, the thing that this really stuck with me, and this was in Chaos Protocols rather than Pieces of Eight, was the impact of crash carts on the dramatic explosion of near-death experiences, because suddenly we had a way of bringing people back from the principal cause of death in the West. And so all of a sudden we have this explosion of near-death experience research. And that is one of those interesting intertwinings of technology in the spirit world that I think people need to examine closer. And sort of sadly, it's one of the ones that we've missed in that Whitley Strieber sense. Because if there is a separate reality to these things, which obviously we all think there is, it would stand to reason that we would get an explosion of them when we found a way to reverse the principal cause of death. And that's happened. And so we need to take very seriously the fact that, on a broad sense, the kind of classic NDE experience does look remarkably similar to traditional conceptions of the afterlife and the experience of moving from life into death. So Psi research that allows you to line up with things that have been described to us, or that previous humans have described, I think is the most interesting. So there are ones like that, and obviously Dr. Dean Radin's Burning Man group experiments. So the idea that there is a fundamental, there is an observable effect on physical reality of a group of people focusing on a thought or a particular outcome, that alone should like break everyone's internet. And there are examples of that earlier in the 20th century, like the work of William Tiller. So all of these pieces you put together, and it's funny, this is kind of coming back to the dominant of witchcraft thing. You can start there, or you can start with an examination of the nefarious history of physics in the 20th century. And you end up in the same place, because if you study the nefarious physics of history in the 20th century, you kind of pull that along and go, well, there's probably some kind of Dirac C or ether or something that has been deliberately excluded from public physics because it has huge geopolitical implications. So you get to the end of the 20, and all of a sudden you're kind of looking at, well, hang on, so there's an ether. You're kind of looking back across at after-death research, or you can take after-death research to its inevitable conclusion's the wrong word, inevitable firm hypothesis, and then all of a sudden you're looking at hidden physics. So it kind of doesn't really matter where you are on the experimentation or exploration of the anomalous. You kind of know you're smoking the good stuff when you are heading in the direction of Fort's dominant of witchcraft. So those are the ones in terms of psi that interest me, but it doesn't really matter. If people are more interested in telepathy experiments, then go and have your world broken by becoming fairly well versed in the fact that telepathy exists.
The thing about near-death experiences that always stands out to me isn't so much the afterlife experience, but the out-of-body experience that can be fairly well verified after the fact. You know, where they're seeing what they're doing in the room, because that says right there, there's no way they could know that. And there's been, you know, controls done where they've just asked everybody, and even people who have not had near-death experiences, and said, well, what do you think happened? And of course, you get this sort of TV version of, you know, the operation going on where they look at it and go, yep, that's nothing like what happened to this person. But when someone claims to have a near-death experience, they're giving the exact details down to, like, you know, shoe color someone's wearing, who came into the room, and so on and so forth.
Dr. Pim van Lommel has two examples of blind people who've had near-death experiences that start with what he calls veridical OBEs. So riddle me that. So the idea that you're waking up during surgery, which undoubtedly happens, right? It's not an issue, but for a blind person to describe what's going on during their surgery, that's not described by that person waking up because they're blind.
Yeah.
So this is the fun thing. You go, you only need one of them. You only need one of them to break the whole world. And we have thousands. And, and that's terribly appealing. And I hoard them because, they're fun to just keep around, I guess.
And it's fun watching the materialists twist themselves, you know, into pretzels, trying to explain, you know, possibly how that could have happened too. Go ahead, Sarah.
There was a guy on Skeptico who worked in Project Stargate. And this has to be my favorite explanation for a near-death experience that I've heard so far. Although he completely believes in Psi, because he worked on Project Stargate and saw it, you know, remote viewing and stuff happen all the time. He said the near-death experience, that that you die at death, that there's no afterlife, and all near-death experiences are either precognition or postcognition, that they're just psi of you picking up that information either right before you die or right after you come back.
See, in a funny way, I don't really. I think in some sense there is merit in having multiple hypotheses running. So
sure.
Another example would be Dr. Jim Tucker's past life experiment, or past life research into the things that small children remember.
Right.
Because there is a sort of super sci model for it, which is they're trying to work out, they've picked up from, you know, you can call it the Akashic Record, whatever you want to call it, wherever the remote viewers get their information from, they're just kind of picking up stories. Right. Of people who previously existed. And in some respects, it's useful to have multiple hypotheses running, even if you stack them in terms of favorites, because you're, okay, well then let's try and let's find the things that disqualify these hypotheses. So I don't necessarily mind if people, I don't think that's correct, obviously, to do with the near-death experience. I don't think that's a good description of near-death experience, because it doesn't match, as you just kind of mentioned, veridical OBEs and the other pieces of it that suggest that, that imply that a better match for the data is a description of you leaving the physical part of you and going somewhere else. And I don't know if that is a good match for that description of NDEs. And this is good, like, because you kind of got to run down it, because otherwise you do need to retain that sort of data analysis. And I don't mind having zany schemes, as long as people are willing to go, well, yeah, you have a good point there, rather than no, you're wrong.
Okay. All right. The other thing about near-death experiences, though, is that we don't actually know if that's what happens when we finally die.
No, and this is, that's interesting. It's interesting to me that it's not universal, as in terms of the people who have been clinically dead and come back. Now, it's a hugely traumatic experience, so obviously that might be part of it, but it's nevertheless interesting that not everyone has them. And that was something Dr. Pim van Lommel worked on, like wondered about when he was doing his research in the Low Countries. And I don't know. One of the things that I talked to Leslie Kane about that I liked is that the highest percentage experience of something to do with death after death and so on is what are called ELEs, or the end of life experience. So, and that's approaching a little bit over 60% of people who are dying but retain some capacity to sort of speak. A little bit over 60% of them describe some very similar things to do with their parents or grandfather or whoever it is, or angels or what have you, appearing in the room that only they can see, and that, you know, that being part of it. Now, that's quite encouraging, because that's a very high percentage one. And it's also, you know, we all hope that that's how we go, right? Like,
sure.
Not in pain and not medicated and so on. So people who die consciously, 60% of the people who have either come back or retain some capacity to speak towards the end will describe the appearance of these beings. So again, it's a question of having the data there and working out which model fits that, plus NDEs, plus veridical OBEs, to kind of squint down to a workable model of an other world.
Plus, you know, Peak and Darien experiences, mediumship, and, you know, that adds another layer to it.
No, absolutely. And it really depends on which one, as an initial area of research, you feel either most interested in or most comfortable exploring, because you'll get to the end of it, and it's kind of like with the hidden physics. You get to the end of it, and then the wrap up, and you'll be like, well, goodness, I'm in a much bigger world now.
there's also the connections that, like Dr. Ring had pointed out, between the near-death experience and the UFO experience. And then, of course, you have the other side, you have Strieber and Ann Strieber particularly pointing out that, you know, there are dead people involved in abduction accounts.
Mm-hmm. Very commonly. And that's we'll call that, like, that's maybe not freshman after death research. You kind of want to wait for year two for that, but it necessarily implies something in that fort dominant of witchcraft sense about, and for me personally, I think it's the least, well, Occam's razor would suggest that there is one spirit world. Rather than multiplying unnecessarily to, like, and this is the one the humans go to, and this is what's over here, and so on, because you do get a blending of accounts. Mm-hmm. And I think people end up there. This is where Fort ended up, frankly. I think people end up there conceptually, depending on where it is that they actually start. But usually you kind of want to begin with people saying, well, grandma's going to come and get you when you die. Here's my proof, or here's my evidence, and then let them chew on that, and then by next year they're out here with us.
I had a question about the dominant of witchcraft, which I love as a descriptor of sort of the age we're in or entering, or moving more deeply into. How much of that do you think is being ushered in by something you also talk about a lot, which is the failure of materialistic science when we look at replicability? And you know, I work with a lot of scientists, and it seems so many of them are hesitant to really even go near that, you know, I guess Bigfoot in the room or whatever you might want to call it, the entire edifice of what they're doing is just falling apart completely.
Well, you know, that seems to be going around. That would appear to be what's actually going on. We're at a stage, you know, an archonic interregnum where the former descriptions of reality have collapsed or are collapsing. And it's a question of how you individually navigate that. Because that is a big part of it. And historically, if you look at cultural collapses. They are populated by fortune tellers and witches and wizards and so on. That's literally, as I kind of hinted at earlier, that's how we got this sort of Solomonic grimoires in Europe, was because the Byzantine Empire collapsed and you have all these Greek scholars and their texts showing up in Italy. You had the same thing at the collapse of Rome, and it's interesting that it's never been, literally never been more popular in the West than now. And I mean that on an absolute numbers basis. There's never been more people openly practicing magic in 2017 than ever, because there are more people. It's a big factor.
Sure.
But on a nominal basis, there are more practicing magicians now than ever before. That's interesting, given, as you just sort of mentioned, Michael, the previous and previously presumed to be solid foundations of a shared worldview are anything but solid.
Okay. Let's see. There's a couple of bigger questions I want to get to. Let's cover this real quick. What do you feel the importance of mythology is? The hero's quest and all of that?
I think that's a good question. If you don't engage with it, Hero's Quest for your own Hero's Quest, you inherit one. You inherit whatever's lying around in popular culture and fed to you through television and the internet and so on, and they're not very good. The ones that are on offer, if you don't go and get them, are quite low nutrition from a psychological perspective. And what's probably interesting about that, and I kind of have a C.S. Lewis quote in Piece of Eight, which is him sort of saying that when it comes to mythology and the unconscious and so on, where your unconscious is sort of at the edge of like an outcropping, and beyond it is this kind of sea of what is actually the universe. So I don't know how it all works yet, but you have an ether or a Dirac C or something in a physics sense. And we have a spirit world. And we have these stories that are very old. I mean, Starships is about kind of tracking where the general shape of particularly magical, but in a broad sense, Western cultural mythologies may have emerged from. But even further than that, back, like Jung said, people don't have ideas, but ideas have people. So these shapes could be 20 million years old. Like I can trace them back 20,000 years, 50,000 years, what have you. But they could be 20 million years old that they just didn't have people to express in. And that's quite interesting. And there is something very profound about sort of asserting sovereignty over experience of mythology as it transforms your life, which it does, that suggests it says something about your role in life. It says something about what you are a physical being at this point in time to do. And so you can't not do it. Your physical existence is the shape of a hero's quest. And if you don't engage with it, then you've just kind of wasted it. You've sort of absorbed the not great parts of popular culture. And you see that. You see people aspiring to be Kardashians. And you go, I don't know if that's a particular I don't know if that's a particularly good use of your physical form.
Yeah.
Especially as there's no difference in effort in exploring what that has like a wider beneficial uplift. So for me, mythology is kind of the stories that shape physical existence and probably non-physical, and we don't know where they came from. And there's something about exploring it that means you can't not explore philosophy and wider sort of speculating about the universe. And that, again, weirdly enough, coming back to the sort of chaos magic turn, that's the kind of stuff in an understanding of psychology and comparative mythology wasn't really there in the 80s. Quite rightly, they'd gotten rid of the sort of high imperial version of comparative mythology, which is everything descended from a culture that we liked and found its fullest expression in a white European culture. So that was destroyed by postmodernism, and rightly so. in the 70s. But that means in the 80s, there's this whole, well, nothing connects to anything else. And that's also not true. So we're kind of at a, we have the opportunity now to compare things in a way that, as long as it's done consciously, can be done in a kind of decolonizing or as decolonizing as possible way. And there's gold in them, they're hills. So that's, mythology seems to be where it's at right now. And I think that's a positive turn.
It's also never been, we've never had the option to explore so many mythologies too, which I find interesting. You know, reading, I think what I recall reading an article about bronies who are creating tulpas of, you know, they're my favorite pony characters and stuff like that. So has postmodernity really, I mean, has it just kind of, you know, exploded, vomited out, you know, all of these, you know, mythologies? Do you think maybe people are getting a little too lost? Is there value in looking to, you know, established traditions and working established traditions versus, you know, going, you know, off into the stratosphere of like these kind of pop mythologies?
Probably because it works better. So I have a lot of respect for postmodernism because it destroyed a lot of these unexamined imperial motifs. But it's not a very good descriptive worldview. It brings the sword rather than the plowshare, and as I said, rightly so, because a lot of things needed to be destroyed conceptually. But we're now in a post-postmodernist world, and weirdly, this is what this is expressed in troubling and devolved forms politically. But it's because it's the dominant of witchcraft. There has to be, or at least I hope there is, a way of looking at in an era of kind of infinite narrative. And hopefully this is the kind of decolonizing thing. And hopefully in an era where we can look at these things with minimized, you know, racial and cultural implications, there has to be a way of determining which ones are almost objectively better, which ones are richer, which ones are deeper, which ones have a greater kind of narrative taste to them than the ones that are on offer. And that is the challenge of today. And I actually think it's broadly positive that things like mythology and folklore are as popular as they are. I'm not happy with, obviously I'm not happy with the sort of mutated political versions of it, but I'm also not that happy with how some of it's expressed online. But it's early days, you know. This is the only thing people know how to do, so at least they're interested in it, and we'll see what it looks like in 20 years time. But it's the story of today. It's actually the story of how do I look back culturally on an individual basis at what my culture has to offer and what other cultures have to offer, and how do they exist in tension and dialogue to have this sort of more enriching experience of each other in the world. It's that relational thing. I don't have the answers for it. I'm very grateful and optimistic that people are thinking these thoughts, and we'll see where they go.
That brings up something else you write about also, and that's appropriation. You know, again, a very sticky, a very big topic, but I love to hear what you think about, like, how do we remain aware of what is appropriation versus picking up something from a culture or a magical tradition or a philosophical system and using it without crossing that particular line.
It's two discussions. The first one is specifically in magic. Two things are in play. So I had years ago, maybe a decade ago, I sort of put this heuristic up on the blog, which was do not go further into another culture's magical practice than the lay people in that culture go. So don't declare yourself a mumbo, but you can. Nothing is stopping you from using. Well, there should be nothing stopping you from using the publicly available, commonly understood charms that exist within, say, a Haitian voodoo context. And by publicly available, commonly understood, I mean the same way we do salt over the shoulder. So because this culture is its own thing and it is allowed to interact with the rest of the world, that should be fine. But don't call yourself a mumbo. So there's on a specifically magical level, there's that. But the other part of it is, and this is a post that I was quite proud of, but no one else seemed to care about. Again, this is about 4 years ago, maybe. Tapu has its own teeth, which is these things are real, and they will squish you if you do them wrong. And so whilst I say here's a good heuristic, don't go further into a culture than the lay people practice within that culture. If you do, one, you're just, I was about to swear again, sorry, Soraya, but if you do, you're a bad word, but also you'll probably get squished. And so in some respects, yeah, go for it. You know, go and pretend you are all these things that you aren't, and let me know how that works out. So magic as a subset of culture has sort of its own guidelines for appropriation. And I think those are the only two, because magic itself is polyvalent. It's already a polyglot. If you read the Greek magical papyri, it's Jewish and Egyptian and Greek and Babylonian and you know, elsewhere mixed together. Like in the one enchantment, it's different god names and angels and so on, because there is that attitude, that cunning man attitude we were talking about earlier, which these things work, and I move towards the things that work that don't. And that is that is the reality of the magical worldview. But magic is a subset of culture. So if we step the appropriation conversation up to a cultural level, that's in many respects more interesting. One, it's because that's in fact where you do find appropriation. That's where you find people wearing First Nation headdresses to you know, music festivals and so on. And that's gross and it shouldn't be done. And people should be shamed on the internet when they do it. And in some respects, I actually think a lot of that is in fact going away. I think people are generally aware that we need a new way of keeping cultures in dialogue and tension. And I describe it that way because we can't be like an OCD toddler not wanting its food to touch, because that diminishes everyone involved. There needs to be, and there always will be, some bleed through. And I think the best thing, the only thing we can do is to be interested and also be aware of the direction our interest comes from. So, and I know that's sort of a weird way of describing it, but if you are interested, there's nothing stopping you from reading everything in English about Shinto mythology, nothing at all stopping. And you should, like, if you're interested in it, just because you're not born Japanese or of Japanese extraction or so on, that's available to you. You could be, you know, if you're Nigerian and interested in Shinto mythology, go nuts. And I don't know how to say it other than we kind of need to continue to do that, because in many respects, I think that's a good way of having the world have a more rational dialogue, but also just be aware of the direction in which you're coming, and don't make truth claims that you probably shouldn't make.
Makes perfect sense.
All right. And part two will be next week, or if you're a Patreon, you will get it in a day or so, if not sooner. And I have to thank Gordon for being patient, because for the first time ever, I forgot to record when we started doing this interview. And we got about 10 or 15 minutes in, and I realized my software wasn't running. Totally my fault. I've never done that before. And he was very patient and understanding and had no problem just starting over and going through the same few minutes again, and probably a little bit better since we knew where we were going with it the second time around. Hope you enjoyed it. Again, part two next week. We have a show coming up this week on Fatima and the Antikythera device, or Antikythera mechanism, both of which have had anniversaries just recently. So follow us on Facebook, join the Facebook group. We're on Twitter, and of course, www.wheretheroadgo.com. And we're going to end tonight with a band called Spazar. And this is actually recorded live in the WVBR studio. It is during my other show, The Last Exit for the Lost, my music show. And these guys just absolutely blew me away. If you want to check them out, they are on Facebook. It's Spazzare. And this is a song, again, live in studio, called Patience. See you next time.